Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 186 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet and novelist Martina Evans talks with Julia Copus about her work as a hospital radiographer, the influence of dream lives, and why she said no to fiction.
Martina Evans is a poet and novelist, born in County Cork, but now living in London. Her first novel, Midnight Feast, won the Betty Trask Award in 1995. In 2016, Carcanet brought out her new and selected poems entitled The Windows of Graceland. As well as working for the Royal Literary Fund, she is associate lecturer at Birkbeck University and also teaches creative writing at the City Literary Institute. I joined Martina at her home in northeast London, where she lives with her daughter Leodorne and her two cats Dora and Donny, to talk radiography, dream lives, and saying no to fiction. So Martina, just to start by talking a bit about your real life background. You were born in Burnfort in County Cork, a place you bring vividly to life in your 2014 collection, Burnfort, Las Vegas, but also elsewhere in other poems. What was life like for the young Martina growing up? When did your love of words begin? Was poetry there from the start?
Definitely, I think. I mean, I think it's interesting to think about it because I think it affects the way I write. I grew up in a pub in the 60s where people still, everybody might stand up and recite something or sing a song. So there was this idea of people performing, and simultaneously I discovered books, which I escaped into a lot. And I think both of those inform my writing because I have a love of the dramatic, of the voice, the human voice speaking. Dramatic monologues, I'm very interested in them because so many characters came in.
Did it feel like a natural thing, therefore, to want to tell your own?
No, in the sense that seemed a bit big-headed. Perhaps I didn't intend to be a writer, but I had written as a child, but it was like a game and, you know, stapling little books together and writing poems and stories. But I became very self-conscious as a teenager and stopped completely and really just wanted to be an English teacher, but got sidetracked. I had a family who thought, you know, studying English wasn't very sensible, and they were quite sciencey orientated. Uh-huh. My sister studied medicine, another sister.
So did you get pushed in a different direction?
Definitely pushed in a different direction. Right. And I remember going away to boarding school. I was with my sister choosing my subjects, and it was either art or commerce. And my sister said, oh, it would be like you to want to do art, but you'll do commerce.
How old was your sister? What was the age gap?
3 years.
Okay, so she's three years older.
Yeah. So I think there was that kind of attitude that, you know, you had to do something that would get you a job.
But the little girl who'd stapled books together, a la Bronte sisters, I suppose, and brother, was still inside you. So what did you end up doing?
Yes, so I went off to university and did 2 years of science and then switched to radiography, which they thought would be a really good job for me. Mm-hmm. I would have loved to have done art, but I did an awful lot of art with my daughter when she was young.
Who is an artist now, isn't she?
Yeah. And our work kind of dovetails a lot. I think where we meet in the middle because we both love film.
Because your writing is very visual. I mean, yeah. There are lots of passages in your poems that are very easy to see.
Yeah, because I think film is very related to poetry. You know, Eisenstein, the Soviet director, said he learned everything about filmmaking from Milton.
How interesting.
And Milton was blind.
Yes.
So it was like he had a huge cinema in his mind. It's incredibly visual. Yeah. I was then doing radiography. And what I would like to say about it is that I am returning to it a lot in my mind now.
Because there's an interesting, obvious link between radiography and poetry. That's sort of looking under the surface of things. Is that a bit too easy a link?
I'll tell you a funny thing about it was that when I first started doing interviews as a writer, and I was interviewing homeless men at Arlington House in Camden Town, whenever I got home, I used to say, and I x-rayed so-and-so. And I did quite a few interviews for the Irish Post as well around that time. And I always said that I was x-raying them. So that's something that happened unconsciously. And I think you could relate that right back to my mother. My mother loved talking. But she also loved to get other people to talk to her. Mm. And one of her favourite sayings was, and then he opened up completely to me.
The magic moment.
Yeah. So that was the unconscious thing about the x-raying, the storytelling, the talking to people, the interviews, the patients, the students. Yes. So that's one side of x-ray. But the other side of it is, I just think the skeleton itself is quite haunting.
Mm.
But I used to find it very interesting, probably because I wasn't a totally typical radiographer, because I would often step back and see the skeleton. Whereas I think if you're really serious about the work, you don't stand back.
Mm.
There was a particular x-ray called the Berry and Meal. I don't know if you know it.
Yes, it's on I know, yeah.
And so a professional would be looking at the berry and moving down the esophagus, where I used to stand back and look, wow, that's a skeleton opening his mouth and taking a drink. It's like radiography was interesting because even though people thought it was automatic, to take a really good x-ray was quite a feat. And in a way, that kind of tricking around and trying to get it exactly right.
Yes. That sounds like good training.
That's like poetry.
Yeah. So moving on to the early days of your writing career, I know that you sent your first poem out to a magazine in 1988, which was the same year that your father died. Were those two events, both of them momentous in their own ways, were they connected at all?
Completely connected. Absolutely and completely connected. So I think the poem came out in 90.
Right.
So he had cancer.
It was a catalyst for your...
Absolutely.
Right.
He was born in 1902.
Right.
So he was 59 when I was born. He had cancer. I was a radiographer. You know, I knew the progression, prostate cancer, bone cancer. He died of secondaries of the brain. And when he died, it just... I feel quite tearful thinking about it now. It just tore me apart. But there was nowhere to kind of put that stuff, I think, or I didn't know what to do with it. So I found myself writing poems. So that I just unleashed a load of unconscious kind of torrent poured out. And then I began to like it. Then I began to shape it.
So you'd had in your mind that you would perhaps be a fiction writer.
Mm-hmm.
And it just came out in the form of poetry.
Yeah, I had written some fiction and I found it afterwards and actually was okay. Mm. Not much different to what I wrote further down the line. But poetry, there's nothing like it.
Mm. Say a bit more about that.
I mean, it's like flying. Poetry is like flying. And writing fiction is like being tied down. It's really hard to describe. I think there's very fast connections. And I love the way it's so succinct and economical and you can get so much together quickly. I get very impatient with fiction.
You make fiction and poetry sound like polar opposites almost, of the flying and the being tied down. Can you say a bit more about tied down by fiction?
I think part of that is the economics of the situation. Because I think once you write fiction, people are going to start telling you it has to be this way, it has to be that way, it has to be a certain length.
Mm.
With my first book, which I rewrote recently, which came out with Random House, I was told that the ending was too downbeat. People would wonder why they had spent $6.99 and got to that ending. But I have rewritten it since and reissued it myself with the downbeat ending.
With the original ending.
Yeah. So I think that's part of it. I do think it's this myth about everyone has a novel in them is just not true. Because what I find is when students come to creative writing classes, they all find they have a poem in them. Mm. It's much more natural to us. It's the oldest form. It's the most exciting form. There's no end to it. You know, it's totally elastic. It keeps renewing itself. Forms come and go. You know, formless come back. Mm. Free verse, reverse.
Mm.
Always
renewing
itself.
There's always something new to be done within the form of poetry.
Exactly. Yeah. And I do think the fact that the money people aren't interested in it allows that freedom.
Mm. Reading your poems makes me think about the way that we humans are so infused with our memories, with dreams, with the books that we read, the films we see, that these sort of things become a part of our reality. As you say of Wuthering Heights itself at the start of that poem, it's never far away from me. There are things in our lives that are never far away from us, aren't there? That sort of colour the way that we experience life. I'm just wondering if there are other examples, apart from Wuthering Heights, of those sort of things, novels, films, poems, that inform who you are and how you are as a writer.
Yeah, there's so many of them. I think The Diary of Anne Frank was very important to me. I think what happens with me in reading is that I get different favourites at particular times, and then they
get superseded.
Yes, but not always. James Joyce is hugely important to me.
And anything particularly at the moment?
I think my major craze at the moment, and it's been going on for about 10 years, is Stanley Kunitz's The Abduction. That was an amazing, and still is an amazing poem for me.
Yeah.
Incredible construction.
So what is it in the poem, do you think, that you particularly relate to? Is that too hard a question?
No, it's about a woman runs out of the forest with her blouse torn and a bloodstain on her skirt, and she has this amazing story, which actually reminded me a bit of As You Like It, because there's a stag in it, and she's carried aloft on his horns to rest in front of a trampled clearing. She's part of some ceremony, and she says, "Do you believe? Do you believe?" And then the second half, the narrator is looking at her as she sleeps and wondering where she is. And it brings in childhood images, which links with Wuthering Heights.
Yes.
Bleached faces with coals for eyes appearing in the window. You wrote about Hero and Leander, which I absolutely love. And those stories just, they never die. And they're so meaningful. And actually, the older you get, the more you see in them, the Greek mythology.
Yes. They're also a point of contact, aren't they? Because everyone, or not
reference,
lots of people are familiar with them. I think one of the reasons that that kind of thing is so resonant is that, I mean, to me, when I read a Greek myth, it feels like a human psychology are kind of writ large or written into a narrative. That kind of psychic drama is going to be relevant. Moving on to something different. Peter Ackroyd, in his London, the biography, described the road where you now live, rather cruelly, I think, as an area of manifest greyness and misery. And you have written a poem that takes that quotation as its title. And the poem is a wonderful riposte to his comment because it positively streams with life. It's a very watery poem. And the ending is both surreal and firmly rooted in reality. Would you read the ending of that poem for us?
Okay.
Maybe the last eight lines. So I know that the part I'm interested in for you to read now begins with the role of the traffic, which we can certainly hear here today.
And I'd like to say something about it, actually, because Eight Doors Down is the very famous Duke of Wellington, which was the first pub theatre in London.
Right.
And it was run by a man called Gerry O'Neill, who published several novels with Heinemann in the 80s. And he's not as well known as he should be known at all, because his novels are wonderful. And one of them is set in the pub, a fictional version of the Duke of Wellington. And it's a wonderful evocation of Bowles Pond Road in the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. But some things never change. And he has the role of traffic is constantly going through the novel. It's a brilliant novel. So I'm going to go on now. But it's the role of traffic that makes it more of a notion, especially the sound of rushing wheels when it rains, and the uniformed Catholic children slip along the wet pavement like blue fish swimming down the Bowles Pond Road.
I love the way you catch the shushing sound of the sea in those lines. The critic John McAuliffe said of your poetry that it is charming and conversational, but the talkiness disguises the surreal strangeness and bleakness of many of its connections. And I think I would agree with that, except that I think that the surreal strangeness, to use his term, comes over very strongly. I don't think it's sublimated. And another thing that's striking about your work is that you're very deft at moving back and forth between the personal and the overtly political, given that the personal is the political. You do that from poem to poem, and also very often within the same poem. So you do it, for instance, in the 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising, which is a poem written in a form I recognise.
Yeah. Well, it was inspired by your poem, several of your specular poems, but the best known, of course, is The Backseat of My Mother's Car. Although my favourite one, I think I have to say at the moment, is the one about Kim's clothes. What's the title?
Yes, Kim's Clothes.
Kim's Clothes.
Yeah.
I think that should be better known. So this is a shout out for Kim's Clothes.
But the form seems really well suited to your poem because it's a poem about looking back and looking forward at the same time. In fact, you use that phrase in the poem, "Didn't they know how much I'd been looking forward?" But it is looking back too to the original Easter Rising and to this particular personal memory of a later celebration of the Easter Rising. So maybe we should describe what happens in the poem. So the girl, a young girl, wakes and comes down into the bar of the family pub to find that everyone has left and gone off to the celebrations without her. And I think you're so good at capturing an atmosphere by the use of a few spare visual details. And you really do it with the lightest of brushstrokes. So in this poem, we have the girl who's just come down to find everyone's gone off, standing in the empty bar. And the poem says, "And the lager was dull gold in the dim light." And that one image communicates, I think, the whole huge loneliness of the occasion. That feeling of arriving in a place that has been occupied and full of activity and finding it completely empty. And of course, the gold prefigures the green, white and gold of the Irish flag that's being waved at the celebrations without her there. Your poems are packed with colour and visual detail of that kind. Now, we've talked about the fact that you've worked as a radiographer, and I'm wondering if that's partly where the habit of close-up observation comes from. You also say of your mother in one poem that she could chalk up a picture in a handful of words, as indeed can you. Mm. Where do you think that skill for choosing just the right telling detail comes from? I mean, has radiography got anything to do with it, or do you think that's a coincidence that you have that job?
I don't know. I think it might be a coincidence. Maybe it's because I'm just tidy. I just like getting it down just to the right. I was always able to edit, basically.
Right, so you might have started with a clutter of images and you hone and you end up with that one image that does the job of...
That's why I love poetry over fiction. Because I love fiction, I love stories. They were never separated before. They were one and the same thing.
Yes.
Poetry and fiction. And I do think the best novels for me are poems. Wuthering Heights is a poem. And I was reading an article about where poems come from, because a lot of mine are dramatic monologues from characters I've written about. And there's The Night is Darkening Round Me. That Emily Bronte poem is actually not directly biographical. It's one of the characters speaking from Gondel. And a lot of people will come across this poem and think it's Emily Bronte that's standing on the moors. And maybe she did, and of course she did, but it's not. That's not the person who's speaking.
She's quoting. I want to pick up on something that you were hinting at, I think, about... Well, there's a broad assumption that novels are 100% fiction and that poems are pretty much straight autobiography. I mean, generally speaking.
Yeah.
In your case, in your poems, you seem to purposely tease or unsettle the reader by using real names, the names of your daughter, Leodorn, and your cats, for instance. Fact and fiction, as well as waking and dream, are often blended together in your work. One very clear example of this is your poem Wuthering Heights. So the poem is written as a single continuous stanza, it's 25 lines, and it focuses on that chilling moment in the novel when Kathy's ghost appears at the window in the room where Lockwood is sleeping and she asks to be let in. At the same time, the poem's narrator has also been sleeping and dreaming, like Lockwood. And to add another layer, the poem features your real-life cat, Dora, and also your real-life daughter, Leodorn, as well as the dream Leodorn, as it says in the poem. And so we get this sort of big narrative swirl. What I'm wondering is this blending of fact and fiction a way of subverting the reader's expectations? Are you urging the reader to see the world in a less defined, less black and white way? Or does it simply reflect the way that you encounter life yourself?
I think maybe a bit of both.
I was going to say all both.
Yeah, I think both. I'm very interested in dreams, I think. I mean, I write them down. I keep a dream diary. And sometimes I dream what's going to happen. And I think we all do. And so, I also think dreams are very interesting because they break down the time barrier, which is what ties us down.
Yes.
And I think time is the big thing with poetry.
And time in all of your poetry, or much of it, is very elastic rather than being this fixed element.
So the first question you had in a thing you did recently on how to read a poem was, yeah, who's speaking?
Yeah.
And I think people should ask themselves that more.
Yeah. And it's not always an easy or a quick question to answer. Or, indeed, there might be more than one simple answer to it. I mean, you were talking about Hero and Leander, the poem that I wrote, which I wrote in the voice of Hero, the heroine, yeah, of that story, waiting for her lover. But it's me, of course, speaking. And I did have in mind an occasion when I was visited by my beloved under slightly risky circumstances. So some of the most personal poems actually appear to be complete fiction. And they're not.
I think, and you're tapping into feelings. So when a poem is successful, you're getting a feeling across to the reader. And in a way, the circumstances don't really matter. Because I find it irritating when readers are digging around for clues in somebody's life. Because Flannery O'Connor said, you know, you've experienced enough of all the great emotions by the time you're 7. You've got enough material for the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
So really, when you read reader to see that, to feel that, universal emotions, abandonment, jealousy, love, anger, all of these things, and they're all there in Greek mythology as well.
So we've talked a bit about your mother. She is a strong presence in your writing and in your life too. You've said that she haunts your poems, and in the selected poems there are two long monologues in which a mother speaks in lines so long that many of them run over the width of the page.
Yeah.
We get a strong sense in your poems of your mother, or at least the mother that you present, your fictional mother. In Facing the Public, the book we have here, for instance, you say of her that she never had slight trouble sleeping. It was never, never, never for one moment did I get a wink as long as my head lay upon that pillow. What sort of a person was she really, and why do you think it is that she continues to influence and even appear in your poems?
I think she was incredibly important to me, and I think to all of the family, but it was difficult because, I mean, looking back on it now, there was 10 children. So, I mean, she's endlessly fascinating because I think she was very bright. She didn't get much chance to go to school. I think that was frustrating for her. Talented, funny, warm, and also very, very difficult and could be extremely hurtful and mean. And there were all these aspects of her mixed up. I think a lot about the way she spoke. I'm very interested in the way she spoke. She didn't have any Irish, and I'm very interested in the Irish language because it was a very strange thing. You know, we were beaten in school because we had to learn. It was compulsory. 100 years after, it was beaten out of children. And I think a lot of Irish writers are haunted by this ghostly language, which is behind everything. And my mother had a way of using words that was haunted by the Irish language, but it was Irish English she knew. She grew up in County Limerick. It was well stamped out. very Anglo-Irish, rich, horsey countryside. You know, the Irish language tended to cling to the rocks and stones out in the poorer areas in the West. But the way she used words and the buried stuff and the fact that she took a lot of secrets to her grave. She had a habit of starting a story and then suddenly looking at me and saying, "Oh my God, you're going to write about this. I'm not going to say another word."
Because that's in one of your poems, her saying that, isn't it?
I think so. And there's this one, Low Key, where she inadvertently was praising the gentry. She had great time for...
That's right.
Yeah. And in the middle of it, she realises she must stop talking, but she's already left me enough clues and I finish the poem after she's deaf.
And write the poem. Yeah.
I think she had a very interesting life.
Yeah.
I think my father had, oh my God, if I could have him back.
Yeah.
He went through the War of Independence, through the Civil War. And this idea of something always simmering underneath, like the Civil War was always simmering as a child. Mild-mannered old men nursing a half pint would suddenly burst out a few key words. The 77 Republicans that were hung, it was a savage war, it was brother against brother, it was awful. And then Ireland had to just get on with the job. And that was a bubbling wound underneath. So, but she knew a lot of the history, so she told me a lot of stories.
It sounds like she was full of stories.
I mean, she was just full of stories. But I mean, it was just, one of my brothers used to get very irritated because she would just riff and go off on tangents. That probably doesn't sound a bit familiar to you. And that reminds me of another thing that he used to say, get to the point. She was very, very difficult. And I don't think it was resolved when she died. And I think that's part of my journey. That's part of my sadness.
Does any of your desire to write or the impetus to go on writing come out of that sense of wound?
Completely. Even as I'm turning into her.
But it's a way of pausing, isn't it? Pausing that automatic process and sort of taking a bit of a forensic look at what is going on. A sort of radiographer's look.
But there's no end to her for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because after I was divorced, I met her in the kitchen and she had lots of friends with her. And she said, "We're all widows here now. And Martina's divorced." I didn't think she'd speak like this. I thought she'd be disapproving. And she said, "Now we can talk openly about men."
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this process of, I mean, as I understand it, several of your poems or poetry collections began life as novels.
Do you know what I think it was? It's because I wrote a book, a novel, in my innocence, I thought I'll write one book to make money, which was Midnight Feast, and then I will be able to just write poems for the rest of my life. You have a two-book deal, and then people are saying, "No, now next we want this, and then we want that, and then we want the other," and suddenly I was writing more fiction than I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I think they were novels that wanted to be poems, and I just let them out of their cage.
So talk us through, let's take All Alcoholics Are Charm as an example. Did you finish the whole novel?
Probably a whole draft. I mean, I've written drafts and drafts and drafts. Because also I find people think you write poem because you're kind of lazy, and it's like, no, I write so many words. It's just that I want to get it nailed down to the smallest number of words possible. So when Petrol went from a 100,000 novel to a 10,000 verse novel, I was very happy.
This is your long poem, Petrol, which I think there's a video of you reading it on YouTube.
Yes.
But from memory, I should say, without referring to words once.
That was part of a project I did with Mark Hewitt, who's based in Lewis, and he got me to learn my poems off by heart, which I found so difficult, even though...
But you make it look easy.
Yeah, well, it wasn't, and it was torture. But the thing about form is, I think people often think we're just writing a score sheet, and we are in a way, the way we lay out the lines as well, but the visual is really important as well.
Yes.
And it's got to do with print, isn't it? It's got to do with print, because it's to do with the look on the page, because... I think it's Mary Oliver said that free verse came in around the time when people stopped hearing poems and were reading them more.
Yes. Hello, Donny. I should say at this point we have been joined by Donny the cat. So since Citizen, the book Citizen, won the Forward Prize for best collection, there's been a whole raft of prose poetry.
I've had enough of it. I mean,
but there is that sense that the prose poem doesn't have to be as good as a poem in lines, that you can just dispense with that problem of where the line breaks and therefore dispense with all sorts of other technical things as well, which your prose poems don't do.
It's hard for me to judge them, but I'm getting very cross with them now. I don't know.
But you also did it before Citizen came out.
Yeah. It did just occur to me is that I, for my sins, I continued to teach fiction for many years. I know, it was a big mistake, Johnny. I thought so too. For many years, for my sins, I continued to teach fiction. We don't know what influences us. I mean, at one stage I thought my poems got bigger because I was stuck in an office at Queen Mary, miles from the department where the paper was.
Right.
And I only had A3, and I think my poems
expanded
during that period.
That reminds me of something Simon Armitage said about cutting down the length of his lines when he was published by Faber, because... the page is quite narrow.
And they say William Carlos Williams wrote his on a prescription pad.
Yes.
Which makes sense.
This idea of teaching fiction while wanting to teach poetry, I remember talking to Helen Dunmore years and years ago, and she told me that she never really got writer's block, because if she got stuck on a poem, she would just move across to working on some fiction and vice versa. I get the feeling that you're not the sort of writer either who worries about writer's block, or do you?
Well, I'll tell you why I don't worry about writer's block. God, I just sound like my mother there. I'll tell you. My main mission is I have a lot of books to read before I'm dead. To be a great reader is probably more important to me than to be a great writer, because I've no idea what's coming out of me, whether it will last or whatever. But the reading is very important to me. So I always have a huge reading mission, you know, in front of me. I want to read this, that and the other. And then the writing comes out in between. I write when I get the time, and it isn't that often, and I don't worry about it in between. I think all the hopping back and forth from fiction and poetry, which wasn't intended, and I always felt very guilty, like I was two-timing poetry, and also that I don't believe in multitasking. I think we are forced to do it in all levels of our lives. And I always thought poetry was so important. It was a vocation. I know it sounds a bit corny, but it's like a religion to me. And it was a great relief when I finally was able to say, no, I'm going to put everything I have into writing
Saying
poetry.
No to fiction.
Putting everything into poetry, because that's what I'm best at. That's what I love. And I've some hope of being really good at it. And it goes hand in hand with reading. You need to read so much to be really good. You've so much to learn.
Absolutely.
Isn't it Samuel Johnson said about how many books you have to...
Yes, it's the number of books that you will have to turn over in a library before you can... Do you have the exact quote?
When a man writes from his own mind, he writes very rapidly. The greatest part of a writer's time is spent in reading. In order to write, a man will turn over half a library to make one book. I think that relates to something. My poems often tend to come to me very, very quickly, but they've been stewing underneath, and they're the product of an awful lot of reading. I think maybe when I first started being a poet, because I was funny or talky and all these things, I don't think people got that I actually was very serious.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things I love about being an older poet is people now realise that I am serious, and underneath this conversation there are a lot of books.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, that's the other exciting thing about poetry. You will be reading, you'll be experiencing, somebody will remind me of a story, or you'll say something, and next thing, bang, it all comes together.
Yes.
And it's a poem.
Michael Donaghy talked about the two flints, didn't he, striking together. I think he used the sperm and the ovum image. Those two
very
things
male,
come
very
together.
Male,
So occasionally I will come across a line in a poem of yours that makes me laugh out loud. It's something, I think, about the tone of what's being said as much as the content, although sometimes it's the content too. But I mean, a title like The Day My Cat Spoke to Me immediately makes me want to read. And in that particular poem, the cat turns out to be revisiting a series of court hearings and commenting on the unfair way in which she feels her owner has been treated.
Well, actually, it really relates to what we've just been talking about reading.
Yes.
It's actually a take on Frank O'Hara's poem about the sun on Fire Island, where the sun peeps in the window and speaks to him. And his poem, in turn, was a response to Mayakovsky's extraordinary adventure in a summer cottage, where the sun also appeared to tell him how he was doing as a poet. I took the poems into my class at the City Lit, yeah, and I said, this is our exercise. You've got to do something similar. The sun can appear to you to tell you how you're doing as a writer, or, you know, anything, maybe your cat. And it was the only time that class couldn't write. They were frozen on the spot. It was too much. They couldn't possibly do it. And I went home very disappointed. I was on the 38 bus thinking, why couldn't they write that poem? And I just started writing.
You did it for them?
I did it for them.
There's a gentler humour in a poem of yours called Gazebo. So the speaker has grown up with the idea that the word gazebo means one thing, and then it turns out to mean something completely different. I love the idea of words having alternative meanings, sort of shadow versions of themselves. This idea that they can enter the language overheard and not quite fully understood, or not understood at all, like escaped seeds, as the poem has it. It's a lot of fun to read on the page, but it would be a real treat to hear you read that poem aloud. Would you do that for us?
I can recite it, actually.
Oh, how wonderful.
Having said that, I'll probably make a mistake, but I think I can. Gazebo. Gazebo was the word my mother used to describe a mad exhibitionist or a queer hawk. For example, so-and-so was going round like a right gazebo. Naturally, I imagined gazebos had legs and travelled, so I was surprised to see my first one on an English village green going nowhere, the wedding couple toasting each other under its rippling blue and white canopy as cricket bats smacked slowly in the heat. My mother grew up near landed gentry, and the gazebos hidden in their walled gardens must have entered her language like escaped seeds, growing into wild tramps that straggled along the Rathkeel Road on strange, overblown feet.
Martina, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us. Poet and novelist Martina Evans, with a guest appearance from Donny the Cat. And Martina's 2016 poetry collection, Windows of Graceland, is published by Carcanet.
That was Martina Evans in conversation with Julia Kopus. You can find out more about Martina on her website at www.martinaevans.com. And that concludes episode 186, which was recorded and produced by Julia Kopus. Coming up in episode 187... playwright and musician Johnny Wright talks to John Siddiq about his need to write the roles that have been missing from theatre repertoire, his attraction to protagonists who find themselves at odds with the world, and the literary values of hip-hop. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.